Partly, of course, I just want to see what it's like. That's why I'm doing this, if you're wondering. I'm a playwright, not an actor. My home is the study, not the studio. From when I first dreamt of becoming a writer, it always seemed to me a good idea to get Judi Dench to do this sort of thing. For it's a preference, a long-held preference, what you might call a habit of mind, putting words into other people's mouths. And these people are played by people whose profession is to pretend to be other people, for which purpose they adopt gestures, voices, intonations, even sexual attitudes not their own. In the theatre, they affect to be ravished and amused by someone whom they will afterwards run a mile to avoid having dinner with. Likewise, they spit torrents of abuse against an actor whom later in the softness of the night, they will share their bed with. These, the elaborate conventions of show business, so loved, by me at least, so treasured, so much the very heart of my life. And yet, asked to go to Israel, I think, and what? Go to Israel and write a play? The girl at Gatwick asks me where I am going. Tel Aviv, I say, and at once she laughs. Lucky you, she says, and roars with laughter. Why? What is she laughing at? Am I missing something here? What is the joke? What is the joke exactly? People always say that in England we lead shallow lives. Our lives must be shallow because we live in a country where nobody believes in anything anymore. My whole life, I've been told, Western civilization, an old bitch gone in the teeth. And so people say, go to Israel. Because in Israel, at least people are fighting. In Israel, they're fighting for something they believe in. Israel is, first and foremost, a cause. The cause being a patch of land, north to south, on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, lying like a small brown anchovy set down on a school atlas, to which the most persecuted people of modern times, perhaps the most persecuted people of all times, after the matchless catastrophe of the Holocaust, rushed in the perfectly reasonable belief they would never be safe until they had a country of their own. We appealed to the conscience of the world. The world has no conscience. We have no one but ourselves. The fight, the struggle, the historic destiny, the return of the people, the cause. Life, therefore, having a meaning and shape that eludes the rest of us in the endless wash of what the hell are we doing here. In a single day, says an Israeli friend, he experiences events and emotions which would keep a Swede going for a year. Zionism itself, being a movement with only a short history, and distinguished from other political movements of our time by the fact that it was invented by a playwright. Yes, Theodor Herzl, in 1894, takes a mere 3 weeks to write his play, Das Neue Ghetto, in which the Jewish hero, struck down by his enemy, dies at curtainfall, his last words ringing out through the darkened theatre. I want to get out. Out of the ghetto. 9 years later, it is the same Herzl who is chairman of the World Zionist Congress when Lord Lansdowne, on behalf of the magnanimous British Empire, is generous enough to offer a small chunk of Uganda as a suitable place for the Jews to live and observe their national customs. Incredibly, a fair number of delegates are hotly in favour. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, and Africa, after all, is better than nothing. But the option is finally rejected on the grounds that Uganda does not have the spiritual quality the Jews require. From this moment on, the central argument is foreshadowed. Is this a biblical mission? Or is it a secular state? Throughout the 80s, organizations like the Friends of Israel offer to pay for writers to visit their country. On all occasions, I refuse. It is only now, it is only 10 years later, that I realize, almost without noticing, that for some time, my subject as a playwright has been faith. My subject is belief. And so it comes to seem it comes to seem urgent that the 50-year-old British playwright should finally visit the 50-year-old state. The week before, the Israeli novelist David Grossman comes to my house in Hampstead. He says that whenever he comes to London, he makes sure to walk on Hampstead Heath. I have some sort of mineral reaction to the place I don't get anywhere else in the world. Just to breathe the air makes me feel happy. Obscurely, I feel proud when he says this, as if somehow Grossman's happiness in Hampstead reflected credit on me, as if it were part of the glory of happening to be British, to be able, rather casually, to offer foreigners the wonderfulness of Hampstead Heath. But mineral reaction? Grossman has thought so deeply about Israel and has lived so long with questions from people like me that he can't help wincing at my clumsiness. What you call the major problems of Israel can one day be solved. There will be a Palestinian state. When I said this 10 years ago, everyone told me I was crazy, but now in their hearts, people know it will happen. There are huge issues, but they are essentially soluble. What is less soluble is the underlying moral question. How does a majority, which itself has been historically unloved, now deal fairly with an unloved Palestinian minority in their own midst? Are we mature enough? Are we courageous enough to internalize the idea of equality? I say, surely there's a problem at the heart of Zionism. Israel is effectively a religious state. It now admits immigrants of only one faith. Won't it one day have to become a modern country, multicultural, like any other? Grossman smiles. Yes, but for us, that's very difficult. I don't see it the way you do. I don't think you have to be religious to be a Jew. There is no God in my life, but I'm as Jewish as it's possible to be. If you want to understand Israel, look to the Six-Day War. That war changed everything. Myself, I feel we were much more Jewish before 1967. That war destroyed our essential Jewishness, because up till then, places and buildings and stones didn't mean anything to us. They weren't important. What mattered to us were ideas. Something very profound happened to Israel during the Six-Day War. For the first time, we seized land. We took land by conquest. And suddenly, the religious Jew saw the Bible not as a historical story, but as a contemporary operations manual. Yes, I want Israelis to have access to the Wailing Wall. But I don't need to own it. Nor do I need to own any of these holy places. It's new, this idea, that you have to own things. It's new, and it's profoundly un-Jewish. On arrival in Tel Aviv, I am rushed along Californian highways in the company of Sigal Cohen, the young and humorous translator who will accompany me wherever I go. At my nasty Western-style downtown hotel, my chief host, Keith Lawrence, is waiting. He is very thin, like a teddy boy, with tapered trousers and a collarless jacket. Give him a cappuccino, and this could be Old Compton Street. He is the modern face of the British Council. No whiskered old buffer he. He is the man who is bringing stuff like shopping and fucking to Tel Aviv. He has been here 3 months and is very excited. He keeps saying Tel Aviv is sexy and a happening kind of place. Someone says to me later that Tel Aviv is the fucking capital of the world. No chance to observe, because I'm off to eat baked sea bream in a stunning waterside restaurant in the nearby port of Jaffa at the invitation of the Israeli theatre director Eran Baniel. Eran is a fine-looking man in his early 50s, bearded, articulate, in a black corduroy suit. Now we drink Rothschild's red Merlot and discuss the profound divisions which have emerged between the secular and religious ways of life. At the foundation of the state, the religious orthodox were guaranteed a special status. Anyone who entered a yeshiva to study the Talmud was exempted from the army and given a public salary. At the time, there were just 500 students. But by the early 1990s, there were over 100,000, says Eran, effectively living off the state for life. For years, the Jew believed that when the Goy persecuted you, it gave you the right to shortchange him. Hence, the racial stereotype of the Jew who smiles while he swindles you. Well, now we are the Goy. Israel is the Goy. And the religious Orthodox have become the thieving Jew. They go to whoever wants to be Prime Minister and say, yes, you can have our votes, but only if you promise to give us our money. They don't serve in the army, they smile and rob the country blind. Eran, it is clear, is a secular Jew. His life was changed by his famous co-production of Romeo and Juliet. This was presented in the middle of Jerusalem. The Palestinians played the Capulets and the Jews played the Montagues. Eran says he never really understood the occupation until he did this job. Most Israelis, says Eran, don't even notice the Palestinians. They don't see them. Have you seen how Israelis drive? They don't drive. They own the road. His voice is rising now. Have you been to the Palestinian territories? Look how the water is allocated. In the settlements, you have the obscene spectacle of Israelis sitting by their swimming pools while Palestinians carry their drinking water round in jerry cans. He uses a phrase I have heard before. It's un-Jewish. It's un-Jewish behaviour. Eran interests me most when he tells me about an actress he worked with who became religious. One day, she came to him and said that she'd decided to give up acting because it was wrong. All theatre is wrong. All fiction is wrong. God makes the stories. What right have we to invent new ones? Why rival God? Why fabulate? By chance, my own modest piece of fabulation, Amy's View, is currently rehearsing at the Camerai, one of Israel's foremost theatres, which for some reason is situated in a particularly dismal shopping mall, God knows where, in downtown Tel Aviv. In fact, theatre is making me impatient, because I am longing to get going and spend Sabbath in the Jewish settlement of Sheri Tikva, which lies some miles inside the borders of the Palestinian territory. It takes us hours to push our way out of town on a Friday afternoon in the pre-Sabbath rush, but finally Tel Aviv falls away and the road opens out. I think of my Sunday school. Sunday afternoons in a stuffy wooden hall in Bexilonsea. I look from the window of the car and the pale, stony landscape of dusty hills and olive groves feels familiar, like a drawing from memory. I have now to be careful because 10 minutes later, a feeling arrives, unbidden. My mind is slipping. I am dreaming, perhaps, of Israeli wine and fresh fish, when suddenly, in open country at last, it occurs to me as I look out the window.
that the Jews do not belong here. This feeling is so unexpected and, of course, implicitly so inflammatory that I turn, guiltily, blushing, to see whether anyone in the back of the car can tell what I'm thinking. Up till now, I have been in Tel Aviv, a town which, on its surface at least, is sophisticated and Western. And, of course, I have been enchanted by the actors and producers I have met. But now, I am speeding through a huge landmass. I feel the topography. I feel the land, a great, hot continent stretching away to my right, Arab country after Arab country. And for the first time, I understand how odd, how egregious Israel must seem to the Arab eye. Slightly shaky now, distrusting my own processes, we are approaching the border with the West Bank. I have known for some time that Sigal does not approve of my visit to the settlements. Now, as we cross over, she is becoming farouche, shifting in her seat and looking grumpy. I wouldn't do this. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you. It's against my principles, Sigal is saying. But I am riveted by the splendour of the four-lane highway, which cuts across the valley and leads, well, nowhere. Only to this one small settlement. I suppose I had been expecting something pioneering. I had the idea that settlements would be like the Wild West, timber frame buildings slung up, everything muddy and makeshift. Far from it. To my amazement, we are coasting smoothly into an area not unlike Bel Air or Santa Barbara. Nestling in Arab hills is a beautifully landscaped middle-class community of detached houses, each with its own lawn. The nearest I can get to describing it is to say that but for the barriers and the armed guards, it looks like one of those towns Steven Spielberg uses when he wants to show aliens arriving to disrupt total suburban normality. As if this is not surprising enough, I am saying goodbye to Sigal, she certainly ain't staying, and shaking hands not with a couple of bearded zealots, but with Danny and Sarah Weiss, whose American-type home is littered with Delta timetables and yesterday's copy of the New York Times. Sarah is thin, small, open-faced in her 40s. Danny is older, exhausted from travelling around the world as an agent for opera singers. As we walk back after synagogue for the family meal, Danny begins to tell me why they are here. Years ago, they tired of America as a place without any spiritual values and where life is completely empty and meaningless. When they first got here, Danny and Sarah lived in the city, but Sarah decided she wanted to make what she calls a contribution, i.e., to live in a disputed place. What they value here, apart from the sense that they are building something, is the natural friendliness of what I learned to call not the settlement, but the community. When Sarah went to the States for 2 weeks, her neighbours insisted on taking in all six of her children. These same children play safely in the street. It's like America before the fall. At dinner, they are both angry at the frosty reception that Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's controversial prime minister, has just had from American Jews. Americans are furious that he has yielded to the religious orthodox the right to decide who is a Jew. Jews in the US say they loyally support Israel and send it huge sums of money. So what right has some Israeli rabbi to legislate who is and isn't Jewish? Danny and Sarah are unimpressed by this argument. They are also contemptuous of American support. Of course American Jews support Israel. Why wouldn't they? It's simple self-interest. Israel is the insurance policy of the whole Jewish people. So that doesn't impress me at all. No, says Danny. This hotly contested subject leads us naturally to the most hotly contested subject of all. What right people like Danny and Sarah have to be living on land stolen by conquest, and how they answer the charge of deliberate provocation.
Danny says it's quite clear. Yes, it's a good thing to build a new country, to build cities. After the Shoah, that in itself is something good. But Israel must also have roots. It can't just be a bolt hole. It must be a place where life goes right down deep into the soil. God didn't promise the Jews Tel Aviv or Haifa. What he promised them was the land of Judea and Samaria. The justification is in the Bible. In 1967, the Israeli Prime Minister warned the King of Jordan not to join in any Arab attack, so he only had himself to blame when the Israelis moved eastwards to reclaim biblical lands. The Israelis did not start the Six-Day War. It was forced upon them, and it became the greatest victory in Jewish history. His daughter adds quietly, "No, it was the greatest victory in all history." "What's the difference, you asked us," says Danny, "between living in Israel and living in the US? I put it like this. Memorial Day here is a day where we all get out of our cars, wherever we are, in the middle of the road, and we stand for 2 minutes remembering the dead. In the US, it's the day when you have a mattress sale. Memorial Day sale. Mattresses cheap. That's all it means. Here, whether you were secular or religious, you wept on that day that the biblical land was returned." I say that it seems anomalous that in the heart of Palestinian territory there should be an enclave in Hebron where 521 Jewish militants have to be protected by 4,000 Israeli troops. It's a farce. Danny disagrees. Hebron is one of the two most holy Jewish places because it is the first piece of land that Abraham bought. The very first commercial transaction a Jew ever made was when Abraham bought Hebron for 200 shekels. And the deal, says Danny, has never been rescinded. Further, it was in Jerusalem on the Mount of the Rock that Abraham was prepared to offer his son Isaac as a sacrifice to God. It was David who bought Jerusalem. The price is now checked and found to be 400 shekels. Again, says Danny, hitting the table with his finger, a watertight transaction, recorded and still legal. And Solomon, who built the first temple there. The Babylonians destroyed it. Herod built another, and the Romans destroyed that. The ultimate purpose of Jewish life is to build the third temple, which will follow the redemption of the Jews and prefigure the coming of the Messiah. One day, the Arab mosques, which currently stand on the rock, will be gone, and the third temple will rise in their place. All of this is pleasant enough. We are eating and drinking contentedly. But things take a more combative turn with the arrival of their Canadian neighbour, Miriam. At once, the temperature rises. Miriam was one of the first settlers in the pioneering days. In the 80s, she says, you could shop freely in Arab towns, but then the Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, destroyed all that. Later, Miriam had moved back to Tel Aviv, but in her words, "When they signed the Oslo Accord, I thought, here we go again." And defiantly, she decided to do her bit by moving back into a settlement. For these people, Oslo, the first ever peace accord between Jews and Palestinians, is the great betrayal. And the man who signed it, Yitzhak Rabin, who was later gunned down by a Jewish religious fanatic, is, of course, the great betrayer. "He was once Minister of Defence, but I never noticed he did much defending," says Sarah. "Worse than that," says Miriam, "we're only now beginning to know the truth about Rabin's assassination. It turns out," she says, "that Rabin knew in advance that he was going to be assassinated, and he did nothing about it." Hey, why didn't he just buy himself a cross and put himself on it? When Miriam has gone, then Sarah offers to take me for a walk through the deserted streets. It's a dark night,
And in the distance you can see lights from the ramshackle Arab villages and hear their tinny music drifting across. Sarah gestures towards her own prosperous surroundings. The whole world is telling us, freeze, freeze the settlements. But I say, telling someone to freeze is the same as telling them to die. We have to be here. It's incredibly important we're here. Because we know from history that unless we stay here, we have no chance at all. I'm not just talking about the Holocaust. You will find at every point in Jewish history that whenever they thought there was a moment of safety, persecution started again. It makes me laugh when the Americans say that they're our allies. Oh, yes. And just how long would it take you to get here? No, 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 no. It's us and no one else. Look, there's an Arab village over there, and I want them to be able to live here alongside us. I'd like it to be possible, but I don't know. There's a fine line of distrust. I ask her what she means. There is a silence. Then, at bottom, I think they want to kill us. I look at my children, and I want them to live in a peace I never had. But how is it to come about? I don't know. We are silent now as we walk further down the neat, perfumed streets, the stars bright above us and the lights from the Arab villages a subtly nicotine yellow. Up till now, I have been swimming in the coral reef of these arguments, noticing something interesting here, picking out a sudden flash of colour over there. But now, with Sarah, I am out to sea, in the depths of the thing, and my feet no longer touch the bottom. More walking, more silence, this time gloomier. The Lord promised us the land, but he never promised it was going to be easy. You don't come to Israel if you want things to be easy. You may not be religious, but you need deep reserves of faith. We appear to be more divided than at any time in our history, but deep down, the secular people respect the religious people. If the moment came, we'd be united again. This speech moves me. And I like Sarah, though I'd like her more if she didn't go on to tell me that Peres was way offline, the Labour Party was corrupt, and Ben-Gurion was a communist. And a worse thing happens when we get home. She asks me if I'm married and have children. I explain that my wife is Jewish. Her family fled from Turkey. Her mother and father hid from the Nazis for a year in a barn in France. My wife has taken the exact opposite course to their own. Not only has she married a Gentile, but one cousin has married a black man. Another cousin lives with an Arab. And what's funny is, I say laughing, the Jewish family's fine about it. It's the Arab girl who doesn't dare tell hers. I feel Sarah withdraw from me. Up till this, I have been an observer. Now, I am the husband of an assimilationist. So what you're saying is, there won't be any Jews in the next generation, she says. Tell your wife. Maybe she feels accepted. But tell her to remember. To be accepted, you don't have to be the same.
I've reached a low point, it's obvious. And next morning I'm not crazy to get up from my bedroom with its bomb-proof steel door to resume what seems to me a subtly insane dialogue. Nothing wrong with the philosophy. This is how we want to live. So long as you don't attach the lethal dangler, this is how we want to live. So fuck you. But luckily, my mood is not infectious, because at noon we are bowling downhill to spend time with Miriam's family, who are already ranged round the kitchen table eating a delicious-looking stew. Everyone wants to know what I'm doing here, and by way of explanation, I say that I've got a play at the Camerai. Oh, theatre. Well, you must know some very left-wing people. The news that I'm scheduled to meet Menachem Begin's famous son, Benny, leads us back to the subject of Rabin and his wife, Leah. Ugly. A very ugly woman to look at, says someone, getting in an early blow. And what he knew of his own assassination. Suddenly, the atmosphere turns quite nasty. Miriam's elderly husband, Ron, is shouting that everyone knows that the assassin was put up to it by a government agent provocateur. The whole assassination was a plot to discredit the right wing and the settlers. Sarah is becoming equally voluble. Ron, you don't have to twist the facts. I happen to agree with your theory, but it isn't yet proved. Danny tactfully suggests we leave. In the street afterwards, Danny tells his wife to calm down. Just be calm. Just be calm when you talk. I am calm. I am perfectly calm. But I have learnt something important. Nothing unsettles the settlers more than the idea that Rabin's death is their fault. The murder of a Jewish leader by a Jew travesties the very meaning of their existence. To be honest, by now I'm tiring a bit. Ignorance and dismay make an unhappy cocktail. And at lunch, I try to avoid trigger words like Rabin or Bible. But at the end of the meal, we bench. One of their daughters explicates a portion of biblical text. She tells the basic story, something about a patriarch going somewhere to get a wife. And then she introduces a character who is a girl aged either 3 or 14. No two rabbis, she says, have ever agreed on the girl's age. At once, an argument starts up. Sarah says the girl can't possibly have been 3 because later in the story she waters 10 camels. Suddenly, the whole table is yelling, and I am sitting there wondering in the sense of marvelling, that it never occurs to anyone here that maybe the story is simply wrong. Maybe the storyteller just got it wrong. But no, it's the Bible, so it must be true, and it must be our fault if we don't get it. And so we sit here. Can we please stop shouting for a moment? Arguing about whether a girl of 3 can or cannot carry 40 buckets to water her camels. Who speaks for the settlers better than the brilliant Benny Begin? A few days later, he is waiting for me on time, on schedule, at the Knesset in Jerusalem, in the nice democratic canteen, where people like me and Sigal and Keith can mingle with elected members of parliament like him. When I start by asking him a question about Netanyahu, he is steely. This is not what you're here to talk about. You are here to talk about the British mandate. He gets out a personal organizer and jabs angrily at the keypads. Look, David Hare. 215. Mandate. I swallow hard and say that the British period of rule does indeed attract me. At one stage I had wanted to research it, but that, how do I put this? I'm a writer. I can't always predict my own interests, and my interests have deepened. Begin is still scowling. He is a slight man with a manner which seems somehow both modest and confrontational at the same time. His eyes are black as caviar. It's a family quarrel, and I don't talk about family in front of strangers. I say it would help me if he could explain why these conquered places mean so much to him. Why does the Oslo Accord cause him such deep offence? Begin looks at me. He says he will answer by explaining that he has been trying to solve the problem of a notoriously difficult ancient Hebrew message on a stone from the time of the destruction of the first temple in 587 BC. What has interested him is how instantly familiar the stone seemed. It was in the language of the Book of Kings and of Samuel. The prose was a little higher than the prose that I use every day, but I felt very comfortable with it. When it said, harvest, I could see the harvest. I knew the weather. I knew the smells and the seasons. I had read books about this stone, but no stranger had ever brought it close to me. The closeness I felt was a revelation. So you see, David, what you call the emotion of these places is to me the very history of our people. In these places we feel, this is Israel. This is us. Most of what matters in Jewish history happened within 20 miles of Jerusalem. It is inconceivable to be deprived of our right to live there and walk there, to be where our kings ruled and our judges judged, and most important, to walk the hillsides where our prophets prophesied. This is ours because this is us. We're crippled without it. I say, I understand this yearning, this 2,000-year spiritual yearning to go home. But that my time in the settlements has disturbed me. I have met people who are choosing danger, who choose to live in a place of danger, and yet who refuse to negotiate themselves out of that danger. Isn't this a form of madness, to live with no conception of the future? If you mean will we give up land, then no. I have always warned, give up the land and you will not get peace. You will get insecurity. People used to say, well, it's a gamble worth taking. And now they see the results. 260 people killed since Oslo, thousands injured, and all because we made an accommodation with an alliance of terrorists and hoodlums. The more land you give away, the more terrorism there will be. Every hectare conceded to PLO Islamic Jihad becomes a haven of immunity. What we have to confront is the ominous possibility of encouraging a terrorist state right next door to us. People know this. They know it, but they don't want to face it. They go round saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice if it all worked out somehow? They know the facts, but they refuse to draw the conclusions. It won't work out. We are all taken aback by Begin, his intellectual command, his profound and daunting pessimism. And Sigal has gone into one of her silent moods, as if the effort of listening without interrupting has terminally lowered her spirits. Keith, meanwhile, is irrepressibly himself. Israeli rhetoric always reminds him of the lottery. It's all about numbers. Watch for the frequency, he says, with which 48, 67, 73 and 93 keep coming up. Of course, the reason for Keith's cheerfulness may well be that he is about to get rid of me. For today, I have decided to walk through the mirror into Israel's twin, its underside. Nothing prepares you for the physical shock of the passage into Gaza. One writer has said that driving from Israel into the Gaza Strip is like driving from California into Bangladesh. You become so used to the broad highways, the easy sensuality of Israel, that it is the sight of dust, sudden dust, an unholy big brown storm of pure dirt, nothing else, which alerts you to the fact that you are about to enter a society where people earn precisely 8% of what their opposite numbers earn in Israel. Keith and I set off on foot across the concrete strip which divides the two countries. For a moment, it is like a John le Carré movie, as we carry our bags past gun towers down the wide, empty road. And at the exact halfway point, just as in the movies, I am seized, bundled into a waiting car, and driven quickly away, though admittedly by two friendly young Englishwomen. The reason for this haste, it turns out, is that Susanna and Pauline, my new British Council handlers, have just told me that in 20 minutes I will be meeting with Haider Abdel Shafi. Shafi is the most popular politician in Gaza, and it is something of a mystery why he has agreed to see me, since he sees no one. This news fills me with a panic which is purely and simply colonial. For months, my mind has been on Israel, only Israel. Now, I am being rushed towards the unique privilege of an audience with one of Palestine's most revered politicians, and I know fuck all. As we travel along a potholed track, you couldn't call it a road, which leads to the city of Gaza, I am taken aback by what I am seeing. Gaza is an area 45 kilometres by 8. Even now, one third of it is still held by the Israelis on behalf of just 6,000 religious settlers. Around them are crammed 750,000 Palestinians, half of whom live in the refugee camps which were temporarily established in 1948. Dusk comes down and we have stepped back 60 years. As we push past the donkeys, Pauline says, there are the rudiments of civilization. Yellow dustbins donated by the European Union, 18 sets of traffic lights donated by the French, and in a bizarre job creation scheme, there are innumerable young boys dressed as policemen and universally ignored. I sort of prefer that, says Pauline. Inactive police are better than the bloody offensive Israeli police. As soon as we are ushered into Haider Abdel Shafi's elegant living room, it becomes clear why he has agreed to meet me. He thinks that I am the Guardian journalist David Hurst, and as such, the author of a recent two-page expose straplined Shameless in Gaza. Since the 70-year-old Shafi has lately resigned from the legislative body in protest at the notorious corruption of Arafat's regime, he is keen to congratulate me on my work. It seems somehow appropriate to this peculiar, hushed city that a man who knows nothing is now about to interview someone who thinks that he is someone else. If I want to find excuses for Arafat, I suppose I can say that he has spent his life in a liberation movement and so he is unused to not getting his way. Hundreds of millions of dollars have simply disappeared. Arafat is a man who buys people's allegiance, but in a society where law is neglected and never enforced, nothing can ever be right. I ask him what effect the lawlessness is having on the peace process. Shafi, a white-haired figure serving as Turkish coffee and wearing a silver Savile Row suit, laughs. There is no peace process. Even by pretending that there is such a thing, we play into Israeli hands. I was 20 months in Washington negotiating, so I know how Israelis think. Their position has never changed. All they are doing is using physical facts to establish their presence in the land and then to treat it as a fait accompli. It's a strategy, nothing more.
How does Arafat feel? I have no idea. He refuses to reveal his thinking. Friends say he is depressed. I cannot wonder he is depressed. Our most urgent task is to reform ourselves. It's far more important than negotiation with Israel. You can't get anywhere if you live in a society without principle. When Muhammad came back from battle, he said, "We come back from the little strife, and we return to the bigger strife." They asked him what he meant. The strife of the soul. But of course, nowadays, nobody thinks about these things. It is Shafi's achievement to create a calm in us all, and the calm lasts as we step out onto the empty street. I ask, where does Arafat live? It's dark, and not a soul moves. We drive towards the sea. We turn. A quiet avenue of villas. At the end of this road of seaside vernacular, two enormous tanks. Behind them, Arafat's house, looking like any other. We get out. Silence. Only the roar of the surf. The Mediterranean. There'll be a civil war, says Pauline. It's inevitable. The society is simply not functioning. What you are seeing, I'm afraid, is the result of the Intifada. You have to understand that that was a real revolution, and it came up from below, not from the leadership. But now, well, it's like that film with Meryl Streep. What's it called? You mean the one where she's meant to be Danish? No, not that one. The one set during the war. Oh, plenty, I say. I wrote it. She looks at me suspiciously. Yes, well, anyway. The figure of the woman. What's she called? Susan Treherne. Yes, the woman who goes to war at 20 and for whom the peace is this terrible disappointment. It's the same here. It's like plenty. These kids were 13 or 14, some of them were 7 or 8, and they found they could create their own structures. They could have a direct and devastating effect on daily life in Israel. By their actions, they truly achieved something. But now, the energy is gone. The men from Tunis came and stole it. These same kids have grown up and are sitting around in cafes. They have no life, they have no jobs, they're totally disillusioned. There was a point once. There was a reason. You were fighting for a Palestinian state and you were willing to die. What on earth would you die for now? If you struggled now, you'd be arrested, tortured, and put to death, all so that Arafat can go on being corrupt. There are more people in prison today under Arafat than there were under the Israelis. What's the point of dying for a society without rules? If the Israelis were really clever, they'd give the Palestinians every inch of land they want and then stand by and watch them fuck it up. This is a terrible analysis, but it's confirmed when I next travel, this time to the Arab city of Ramallah. My official companion is Muna Khalafi, a sparkling, clever Palestinian who thinks that I'm incredibly lucky to have met Haider Abdel Shafi and who wants to hear every word. Her eyes light up. He is a great man. He is the guts. He is the soul of the country. The new leadership just wants to do business. They did business in Lebanon. They did it in Tunis. They say, just make money. Then later we'll decide what kind of society we want. But Shafi says, you cannot delay this question. Muna asks me why I've come to the Middle East. I say it's hard to explain. It's an instinct. Playwrights are drawn to places without quite knowing why. Most of my work has come from just poking about. Muna
looks at me. That's not a good enough answer. Do you really know what you're doing here? I say yes. Perhaps I'm beginning to. Muna wants me to meet Albert Agazaran, the great Palestinian historian, to talk to him about the problem of Jerusalem. After an hour, Agazaran arrives, a frightening figure with a big pipe and a superb sculpted face, rather like the actor Hugh Griffith. He thrusts an article at me, ordering me to read it. When I dare to ask a question, he sighs and says, "Where do you start? For me, you can only answer this by considering the Egyptian conquest of 1831. And he sets off on a canter through 19th century statistics, which I can't grasp, partly because he scares me so much, and partly because his mind is leaping about like an angry gazelle. However, when I ask him what he thinks the religious Jew truly believes, he starts to cheer up, pleased that we turn out to share a common interest. All the apocalyptic stuff only starts after 1967. You do get a whiff of it before, but it's only after the Six-Day War that the Jews come up with this new interpretation of the Bible. The building of the Third Temple. The end of the world. Please. It's pure opportunism. Religious revelation, which just happens to be the most perfect political connivance. There are women in Jerusalem who've actually started sewing the garments for the priests of the Third Temple, and they're preparing the unblemished animal. You know, what is it? That, what is it? Animal begins with H. H, he shouts.
Heifer?
That's right, heifer. They're preparing the unblemished heifer to purge the temple. And of course it all suits Israel fine. But groups like this always bring bloodshed and violence. Rabin's assassination did not come out of nothing. I ask if he thinks Israel divided. Deeply. Deeply divided. There are three Israels now. The hedonistic Israel of Tel Aviv, the austere Israel of Jerusalem, and the mad Israel of Hebron, which wants only vengeance and blood. Look, I do not discount what the Jews suffered. Nobody can. I know what they suffered in Europe. But to me, it is as if they jumped from a burning building, and they happen to land and break the neck of a man who was passing. And when the man says, "Hey, you've broken my neck," they say, "Sorry, it's because of the fire." And when the man says, "Yes, but my neck's broken," they just break his arm in order to try and shut him up. And when he doesn't shut up, they break his other arm, then they break his leg, then his other leg, all in the hope that he'll one day shut up. But you see, I don't think he will. I ask him if it will change. It will stink before it changes. You have to ask yourself about the so-called peace process. Is its purpose the exchange of land? Or is it the subjugation of the Palestinian people? Because on the ground, there's no question, all the evidence points to the second. What is the reason for all these stupid checkpoints and the impossibility of Arabs getting a visa to visit Jerusalem? Arabs can't visit Jerusalem. On the road back to Jerusalem the other night, he was stopped, as he always is, at the checkpoint. The army girl, who was no older than his own daughter, started to go through his things. When she was putting them back, he said, "Do you like what you do? I have a daughter, and I will give her the right to do many things, but not this, because this is dehumanizing." Do you know what she replied? "I don't think about it. Now, goodbye." Shall I sum it up for you? They always ask two questions. Did you pack the bag yourself? And did anyone give you anything to carry? The other day, when they asked the first question, I answered and I added, "And no one gave me anything to carry." The Israeli guard looked at me, furious. "How dare you? Don't you know you are not allowed to answer the second question until I ask it?" David, that says it all. Albert and I part firm friends.
On the way to the Presto Cafe, where I am to meet the producer of Romeo and Juliet, Muna explains that George Ibrahim is one of the few people in Palestine allowed to make theatre. On arrival, George turns out to be bear-like and convivial, punching my arm whenever he makes a good point. As good points arrive at 30-second intervals, I end up significantly bruised. When we did Romeo and Juliet, then at the end I knew I had been used. Not by Iran personally, of course, but by the Israelis. Before he can say more, we are joined by one of George's best friends, the 42-year-old poet of the Intifada, Hussein Barghouti. With his long, straggly hair and his chain-smoking intensity, I instantly recognise Barghouti as a figure who has tragically disappeared from British life, but whom you still see in Paris and Berlin. The genuine, 24-carat intellectual, arms waving and high as a kite on ideas. George stokes the fire by attacking the portrayal of Arabs in Western films. We are always just puppets. You play with us according to your imagination so that we are monkeys smoking pipes, or more usually, criminals. I hate Hamas myself, so I know that extremists are criminals. But I also know why. I know why they commit crimes. Think. Just think. Think what depths of despair it will take to make you walk into a market with lumps of dynamite tied round your chest. But no American filmmaker has ever tried to think. All Arabs get lumped together. Hussein joins in. Did you see The English Patient? Foreground action. White people. Noble. Fine feelings. Strong. Full of laughter. Walking in gardens. Taking showers. Standing up. Background action. Arabs. Shifty. Mysterious. Dirty. Untrustworthy. Sitting down. You know, I have been reading Mishima, and he is very moving on this subject. The destruction of Japanese culture by the West. The West injecting violence into a culture. All the conflicts in this area are imported. They are not organic. The West collected its religion from here. Yet how did that religion come back to us? In the form of the Crusades. You take your religion from this part of the world and you bring it back to us as violence. I'm happy in Ramallah. It's less desperate, less disturbing than Gaza. But every night I travel back to Jerusalem, where not only half the world's religions started, but also, hardly by coincidence, where the world first started collecting crime statistics. Yes, crime number one, Cain killed Abel. It happened in Jerusalem. And ever since, the story is of massacre and of bloodshed. At Oslo, the question of how Jerusalem should be administered was put to one side as being simply too difficult even to approach. For this Jerusalem is the world capital of claim and counterclaim, the acknowledged metropolis of dispute. Here, contention, abrasion, and mistrust are scored deep into the subtly pink rock. For myself, there's no question. I have to walk the Via Dolorosa, to follow the stations of the cross which represent the steps on Christ's journey to his death. All these stones, all this sadness, all this light. It's the religion of my homeland, even if homeland's not a word I've ever used. But the shock is to realize just how little impact Christianity has made. It's amusing to see busloads of American evangelicals dressed in shell suits and baseball caps, expecting Universal Studios, and instead searching vainly in an old Arab city for any remaining evidence of our Lord. There ought to be more. What's happened? Why is there not more? To be honest, I share their bewilderment. After all, Christianity is a well-known religion, and I'd say influential in its day. You'd think it was still worth a pilgrimage. But in this town, we come a sporting third. We're the sideshow. The Via Dolorosa is a pavement, which winds its way unimpressively past postcard shops and up narrow alleys, filling me with a sense of loss, with a tangible sense of something lost. Until it reaches the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which, wouldn't you know, wouldn't you just guess it, is also disputed. Yes, the church which contains the stone where our Lord was crucified is shared unhappily. 70% to the Greeks, and the rest doled out higgledy-piggledy between the Armenian Christians, the Coptic Christians, the Latins, the Syrians, and the Ethiopians. A people divided by a common religion, sects, and the single church. And what's more, hold on, here we go. Is the stone, in fact, on the right spot? Nobody knows. Archaeologists also dispute. Nobody can know because nobody knows where the city walls were. Nobody agrees. Where was Calvary, indeed? So for now, look, is anything certain? Shall we just do as the family next to me and drop alarmingly to our knees on the working assumption, let's just assume that X marks the spot and kiss the stone? After all, does the literal truth of it matter? Does the literal truth matter? Aren't we kissing an idea? Stones or ideas? Stones or ideas? And it's a relief. I'd say a relief. To come out of the dark and stroll down to the big open plaza where you find the Wailing Wall, strangely impressive, tall, uncrowded, the bit where the Jews are allowed. For towering above them, at the very top of the arrangement, is the most coveted spot in the universe of faith. What the Jews call Temple Mount, but what to the Arabs who occupy it is known as the Haram al-Sharif. And at its centre, the saffron-yellow, golden dome of the rock. I have felt, since I arrived, that Jerusalem doesn't need my admiration. Enough people are obsessed with it already. The truth is, I look at it and think how beautiful it must have been when it was a small town. Myself, I would like Jerusalem more if it were less important. But even I, inside the Arab sanctuary, taking in the cleanest, most oxygenated, sun-dazzled air you ever breathed, looking across to the Mount of Olives, yield to the splendour of the place and realise, oh, I see how provoking it is to own beauty, to own the most breathtaking space of them all. Coming down, Sigal is waiting. I get into the car. The driver doesn't know the city, so we circle for some time. It's interesting. When we stop people in the street to ask them the way to Yad Vashem, the world-famous museum of the Holocaust, some of them don't seem to know. The museum's power is in its very simplicity, a bleak photographic record ending not, as Westerners expect, in 1945, but in 1948 with the foundation of the state. At the centre of the display, I stop at the text of Himmler's speech, the most astonishing document of the war, in which he congratulates his men on the discipline they have shown in exerting what he calls their moral right. to exterminate the Jews. It is, Himmler says, natural tact which prevents any German from speaking of what they are doing. Himmler knows it is hard work digging pits and throwing bodies into them. But what he is proudest of is that in doing this work, his men have... The phrase resonates down the century. His men have stayed decent. And it is staying decent which has made us hard. The only false notes in the museum are hit by works of art, sculptures and paintings. They seem superfluous. In every case, the gesture seems inadequate. What is a painting? A painting of a starving man. What is a painting of a corpse? It's the facts we want. Give us the facts. We walk in the Garden of Remembrance. We begin to feel the sun. Voltaire said, "You must choose between countries where you sweat and countries where you think." The confusing thing about Israel is that it's one where you do both. And my mind is racing now. We're all blind. We all see only what we want to. Don't we blank out the rest? And me, more than anyone, at times I'm the worst of the lot. I've seen a good many politicians while I'm here, but at the end I'm due to meet one who's lost all hope of office. I'm used to hours getting past the security arrangements for the minister of something or other, but my last visit is to a tiny, unsecured basement in Tel Aviv. I have already noticed that the mere name of Shulamit Aloni is enough to attract violent hostility from some who knew her as the flaming red firebrand of the Rabin government. And as she comes, already talking, into the room, she is like a manic depressive Melina Mercury, with thick glasses and no time to wait for the questions. "What do you want to know?" she says, throwing herself down into the biggest chair. "Why do you say it's difficult to understand what's happening? It couldn't be simpler. We're going backwards. What's so difficult to understand? The Jews were once victims, and we're brainwashed to believe that we will always be victims, and victims can do no wrong. Suddenly, we've become strong and greedy and pretend we can justify everything. We're told all the time the Palestinians want to throw us into the sea. We have 6 million people and the strongest army in the region, and yet we speak of them as if they were two equal powers. It's just manipulating people's fears." She raps out an order in Hebrew for Sigal to go and get some coffee. Sigal gets up furious, while Shulamit carries on blaming the reversal entirely on Netanyahu. "I am enjoying Shulamit. She is absolutely, as they say, my cup of tea. But even I am a little surprised by her blaming Netanyahu for everything. Are things ever really down to one man? You are English, and I assume you went to high school," she says rather nastily. "So you will have heard of the philosopher Hobbes. Hobbes says that a whole society can be destroyed by a single individual who decides to come along and burn down the forest. Well, Netanyahu, aided by the greedy fascists, the army, the security forces, is such a man." I ask what she can do meanwhile. Does she just wait? "To wait means to die. I have no optimistic things to tell you. Why come to me? What are you doing here? Go to the younger people and ask them what they think." She is staring at me now, as if it's the first time that she's noticed me at all.
Why you write down my blah blah?
I say that I normally start an interview by explaining what I am doing here, but somehow we had skipped that stage.
It's a bad time. What can I tell you?
It's what you feel.
No, it's not what I feel. It's what I know. If it were only what I feel, I'd go and have a brandy and then I'd feel better. I'm not telling you my mood, though my mood is bad. I'm telling you the facts. I am gloomy. But what do I matter?
She looks me in the eye, challenging me to defy her. This talented lawyer, who has done as much as anyone to offer practical support to the victims of discrimination and segregation, is now lost in pain, painfully lost, and spoiling for a fight.
The great mistake was to give power to the clergy in the first place. And immigrants came from Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean. They were backward. They knew nothing about democracy. They think democracy is ruled by the majority. What's worst, we have no written constitution.
I have not even opened my mouth, and already she is shouting at me.
Don't tell me that you don't have one in England. I know that. I know that. But you have the Magna Carta and Oliver Cromwell and a tradition. And until recently, you had the idea that certain things are not done.
She gets up. It ends as abruptly as it begins.
Anything else? I have to run.
I am aware that this woman's world was destroyed by Rabin's assassination. She shakes my hand.
The British caused a lot of problems here.
I know that.
Do you know what I say to the British? Since you left,
we love you very much. And I mean it. We do. We walk back to the British Council, Sigal fuming at the way Shulamit insulted her and apologising for her manner. I say, it didn't bother me at all. I'm just a pen. I start collating my notes at the office. A British Council worker comes in. His name is George. He is a Christian Arab.
He is my enemy, says Sigal, and the two of them roar with laughter together contentedly.
Shulamit Aloni rings to ask us both to pardon her for being what she calls obnoxious and offensive. She is worn down, she says, by the weight of her caseload. We set off for the airport. On the way in, I've been advised not to let them stamp my passport so that I can visit Arab countries. But on the way out, before I can say a word,
wham! Not a second to speak. And the word Israel is on my passport forever.
Gatwick. My plane is late. I return in the middle of the night. I get on the train to Victoria. Darkness. The power of Simenon, someone observes, is that he always travelled through France by barge. From the canals, he saw only the backs of houses, the backs of churches, the backs of streets. The Israeli military commander, unnamed at his own request, who sits across a desk smiling, telling me that only 20,000 Jews have been killed in the cause of setting up the state. Not that every death isn't a tragedy, please don't misunderstand me. And of course I'm not talking about the Jewish experience in Europe. But the Jewish experience in this part of the world. 20,000, to set up a whole country. That's not bad, you know. Not for a whole state. Not bad at all. Victoria deserted into a black cab, up past Buckingham Palace, Park Lane, and north up the Finchley Road. Passion receding up the broad, tree-lined avenues. Fitzjohn's Avenue. Haider Abdul Shafi, quoting Muhammad on his return from battle. I come back from the little strife, and I return to the greater, the strife of the soul. Netanyahu, on the radio, saying that he is aware, like all the century's greatest men, of being misunderstood, then naming Kirk Douglas as a brick in the Wailing Wall. Sitting in the harbour with Iran Banyel, eating fish. Fuck the land. Fuck it. What does the land matter? The highest value to a Jew is human life. The idea that stones now matter more than lives is a complete deformation of the Jewish religion. A deformation. Left on Chapel Street. Tall terraces of impeccable Georgian houses on either side. I think of David Grossman walking on the heath. I have some sort of mineral reaction, he said. Pauline, in the boarding house in Gaza. There was a point once. There was a reason. You were fighting for a Palestinian state and you were willing to die. What on earth would you die for now? The taxi turns right and right again. Are we where we live? Or are we what we think? Which matters? Stones or ideas? Stones or ideas? My dog, Blanche, waking in the night to greet me. The big white door of my home closing behind me. Via Dolorosa.